What I'd like to do this morning is to just reiterate a few of the facts that we talked about last night in terms of the life of John of the Cross. And I'll try and make that as brief as possible, but to bring you up to date what we discussed, because we want this morning to spend our time on the Night of Sense. And this afternoon, we want to move into the Night of Spirit. The most difficult thing about talking about St. John of the Cross is how in maybe one day or one evening and one day, how do we pick the most important parts of what he is saying to us in all of his literary works? And so, of course, today the theme are the Dark Nights. We're going to focus on the two books of his Dark Nights. But I think we may make reference once in a while to the ascent, as we did last night, to Mount Carmel. But I'd like to, just for the newcomers, to reiterate some points about his life. I said last night that I think any time we talk about a 16th century mystic or saint or from any century, that to really understand what they're saying to us, it's important to me that we get to know the person in as much as we can. And John was born in the year 1542. I'm not going to go through this whole thing. And he was born to a very loving mother and father, and his father was a well-to-do merchant at that time. However, before John reached his third birthday, his father passed away, and it left the family in poverty. And also, we have to factor in the fact that in 16th century Spain, the status, family status, family name was very, very important. And John's father had been disinherited by the family because of him marrying a beautiful woman, young woman named Catalina, who was an orphan. But she'd been raised by a wealthy friend of the family. And when his father died, she begged the family to help assist her in the raising and the financial support of the three brothers and herself, and they rejected her. So it catapulted them into a state of poverty, and eventually they had to move to another location. John was placed in a school for poor children. He was studying, though, Christianity. It was a Christian school. And eventually was taken under the wing of a Jesuit priest who allowed him to go to a high school. And he graduated. And by the time he was in his late teens, he was invited to work at a hospital, sort of like a nursing home, where this Jesuit priest was the administrator. And he is known for his compassion, for his utmost charity to the very dregs of humanity, where this hospital accepted people like that, where they could not get medical care anyplace else. It was expected that he would become a Jesuit, but he surprised everyone at the age of 21, and he entered the Carmelite monastery, and he took on the name of St. John of Matthias. He finished the novitiate. He continued to study theology and was ordained as a priest at age 25. That was the year that he met Teresa of Avila. And I said last night that it is very hard to separate Teresa of Avila with John of the Cross because they were colleagues and they were cohorts in crime in reforming the ancient order of Carmelites. And obviously were not very popular with the OCARMs. And as a result, John was imprisoned later in his ministry in middle age, and he was imprisoned for 9 months. He was tortured. He was confined in a cell that was 6 feet by 10 feet, and by the time he escaped after 9 months, he was close to death. He was nursed back to health in secret by some of Teresa's nuns, novices, as the story goes. And Soon after that, Teresa passed away, and John was not with her when she died, although they remained all of her life and until her death at age 67, that they were very close. So he had years of writing, administration, travel, and eventually he, because of the relationship with the Ancient Order of Carmelites, it did affect John's position, and he is stripped of his offices. And at that time, he became ill. He experienced an ulceration of the leg, which eventually spread to his back and other parts of the body. And by the time he sought medical help in Ubeda, he didn't survive a primitive form of surgery. And he passed away on December 14th in 1591 at the young age of 49. We said that John was small in physical stature. He was 4'11", barely 5 feet tall. So anyway, if you don't have a copy of the timeline of John's life, I have extra copies up here. So we talked a little bit about to kind of set the foundation for the Night of Sense and Night of Spirit. Because John is so big on faith, he wants to impress upon us the value of faith. And faith is a word that is oftentimes not really understood. And I said to the group last night, I said, I once asked a priest, what is faith? Tell me what faith is. You know, how many people have said to you in your life, if you only had faith, if you just have faith, it sounds so simple. So I asked a priest, tell me what this faith is. And he said, well, you should know it's a theological virtue. So I asked how many people would understand if I told you that faith is a theological virtue. Would you have a deep understanding of faith? And so it's important to John. So we'll spend a little bit of time later on this morning talking about what I think he was saying about faith. We talked about the faith in terms of the spiritual journey from the standpoint of believing, which is the cradle of faith. As youngsters, we are asked to believe in something, maybe from our parents, maybe from our church, our school. We're asked to believe a concept that is called God in our culture. So the journey is from believing to knowing. And we know that that's not an intellectual knowing. That's not what John of the Cross is talking about. That's not what we're talking about today. But we're talking about a sacred gnosis, or an interior knowing that John is leading us to through his teachings. When we talk about faith, John starts with faith, but he wants to move us to pure faith. I made the comment that I've heard Father Thomas Keating say, or use synonymously with faith, trust, that faith is really trust. So moving the movement from faith to pure faith says to me that we are being asked to move from trust in God to absolute trust, no doubt. So the last thing that we did, we took a look at from John's illustration of the journey or the ascent to Mount Carmel. And Mount Carmel is a sacred place to the Carmelites, and it represents a place where Elijah met God, and also it is believed that there was an appearance of the Blessed Mother, Mary. So they are very devoted. The Carmelites are very devoted to Mary. And we look at John's pattern of ascent, the Via Negativa. And this turns so many people off because, as one person said to me, well, I don't need more negativity in my life. So I can't bear John. And we know, as I said last night, that many people try to read John and literally run for their life. It's said that John's teachings are tough. And yes, they are tough. But it's also said that they are no tougher than life itself. And I believe that. So John said that there are three paths to the ascent to God. And we can take the path of material life, possessions, roles, all the things that we covet that tend to satisfy our wants, our needs, and desires for what we think that we need in our life to make us happy. Or if anyone has ever had a felt presence of God or want to be loved by God or feel good about their relationship with God or have had extraordinary spiritual experience, we can take the path of spiritual consolations, which usually have their day or short-lived. But John chooses the path of no thing. And in his Via Negativa, the road of the negativa, he is not saying, and I think this is misunderstood, that we cannot possess, have any material possession in our life or relationships or anything like that or anything that gives us pleasure. He's not talking about that. That we cannot feel good about our relationship with God. He's not saying that, but what he is saying, that when it becomes obsessive, we're talking about the aggrandized or exaggerated wants, needs, and desires, that it clouds our perspective of God or becomes an obstacle in our way where they become more important than eternal life, our relationship with God. So he takes the, which is an Eastern term, the one-pointedness to in his relationship with God. But we also said, too, that it may have been a little bit easier for John, but because of his poverty-stricken life and his childhood, the loss of his father, the loss of his brother that died 2 years after his father, that he had much less baggage to let go of, to surrender on the journey than perhaps Teresa of Avila. And I also said, too, as I said earlier, it's hard to separate them because they were so close. They were such good friends in Christ. And Teresa had a lot of material possessions in her life and a lot of baggage that she had to unload, probably like us. So it might have been a little bit easier for John because he never had the things that we have in our life today or what Teresa even had in her life in 16th century Spain. Anyway, so that was just an example of what he talks about in the ascent. Any questions or any comments from last night? Yes, sir.
It's possible because obviously she had all the possessions, so it's possible that she had all the consolations, and since he never really had the possessions, so they're kind of they had opposite. You know, they're coming at the spiritual journey from opposite ends of that particular spectrum.
I think if they had known each other, you have to remember Teresa was 52 right. When she met John, and so she had come through her major conversion experience, where John was 25. And newly ordained. So she had really let go of a lot of those obstacles in her relationship with God and her spiritual journey.
He had experience with letting go of not having possessions.
Right.
And she had experience, maybe had not, because she you said earlier in her life she had, you know, was very much the socialite, the partier, and so forth and so on. So she had a lot of experience through her conversion of giving up all those material possessions, those, you know, those parties, that type of thing. So they had given up in their journeys opposites in that particular diagram.
Yes. Yes, and I think had they known each other, had they been the same age and progressed through that together, yes. But it appeared, of course, by that time, age 52, Teresa was well on her way in reforming the Oak Arms, and she renewed it by putting together the Discalced Carmelites, and we said that last night. And then John joined her in the reform of the Ancient Order of Carmelites with the New Order of Discalced. But what I think about that is that by age 52, and Teresa had done a lot of work, and self-disclosure was very, very important to her. In the Seven Mansions, how many so people keep coming up and saying, oh, I was at the Interior Castle. How many of you attended the Interior Castle? Okay, all right. Okay, so sometimes I like, for those who have been there, I like to kind of go back and relate. In the third mansion, Teresa says that we will never leave the third mansion of the interior castle. She's talking about stages of relationship with God. She's talking about stages of consciousness. So, unless we can reach a place of self-disclosure. And to me, that is just owning all of the baggage and the stuff that is ours. And Father Thomas has taught us well in defining it as the false self-value system and then the movement to the dismantling process. Now, it appears, I'm sure John suffered as a child with the loss of family members and the poverty. But by age 25, he was already very advanced on the spiritual journey. And Teresa recognized that in him, and we said last night became his spiritual director. But as Teresa aged, and in the last years of her life, it appears that John, because of his profound advancement and relationship with God, became her spiritual director. But both of them were extraordinarily blessed, and in terms of relationship with God. And I think I made the comment last night that I have heard Father Thomas Keating say that they had an unusual and probably extraordinary, for their time, for 16th century Spain, understanding of the psychological, the human psyche. And because we have to remember that the unconscious was not even discovered by Freud until mid-1800s. So anyway, in a nutshell, that's where we began last night. Any other questions about anything that came up in your thoughts last night or anything that was not clear? Okay. Who is John of the Cross? We know he was a 16th century priest, monk, Carmelite, now Discalced Carmelite, entered as an Oak Arm, Ancient Order of Carmelites. He's a reformer as he worked with Teresa to reform the Ancient Order and established a new order called Discalced, which means wearing sandals or shoeless. He was an author and he was a teacher. I think it is important for us to understand who Teresa and John were writing for and who they were teaching. And primarily, they were teaching the novices that entered the 17 monasteries that Teresa established and the three Carmelite monasteries for friars that John established along the way. However, we also know that they shared their teachings and their insights and relationship with God with lay people along the way who would sometimes house them as they went by horse and cart, visiting those monasteries and doing the work that they were prescribed to do. So we also know from the letters from John of the Cross, I think some of which are in the back of the collected works of John, that he had good friends and they were lay people and not always religious, and that he wrote beautiful letters that always expressed utmost charity. So His four major literary works, The Ascent of Mount Carmel, The Dark Night of the Soul, which we're focusing on today, The Spiritual Canticle, and The Living Flame of Love. And incidentally, if you didn't know it, Contemplative Outreach has a two-year program entitled The Living Flame. And it has a series of topics that build one on the other. And generally, people in the chapters will embrace the program for 1 year. And then they have the option of continuing in the second year or not. And I will say that most people do continue. And anyway, and so in the Living Flame program, yes?
I just wanted to insert there, too, that you can go to the archive and get just pieces, you know, little blips of that whole series. There's 50, I think at least 50 pieces that you can listen to right from the archive of contemplativeoutreach.org.
Great. On the Living Flame?
On the Living Flame.
Yeah.
Yes.
Wonderful.
So in the Living Flame program, there is a session on the Night of Sense, and in the second year, we close the session, the second level of Living Flame, with the Night of Spirit. And I'll be closing the second year of the Living Flame program in Hartford, Connecticut next month with the Night of Spirit. But you get a taste, because we don't have a lot of time in just one day. And anyway, so we will do what we can do with the Night of Sense and Night of Spirit today. If there are no more questions, no more comments. Yes?
Where did you get that information?
The Contemplative Outreach website.
ContemplativeOutreach.org. You just go to the video archives, and there's four series there. Living Flame.
Heartfulness.
Two ladies, pass this on.
I can't remember the name of it, but there's four different series that you can access. They're very short, 2 or 3 minutes.
Okay. Here's an immense information on the website. Just if you ever have time, if you have hours to browse it, it's just rich with information on the contemplative dimension. Anyway, moving into the Night of Sense, I am asking the handout that you're going to receive is, we'll talk about that when you get it, but it makes reference to the Night of Sense and Night of Spirit, and it's a metaphor of our lives on the spiritual journey. So when you have it, I'll speak more about it. The Night of Sense contains three classical signs that one is experiencing a Night of Sense, and three classical trials. So let's take a look at those so we can better understand what John is saying about the Night of Sense and why he calls it the Night of Sense. Oh, one of the things that I think is important for the people who were not here last night and came in this morning. So I just want to backtrack for a moment. We talked a little bit about what does John mean when he says dark. And we said that his way is charting the fundamental journey where no words satisfy. And it is the experience, this dark stages that he's talking about of our life on the committed journey, is the experience of being simultaneously wounded. And to me, what does that say to me? That says to me that when I become aware of the obstacles in my life on the journey that require change, I know I am wounded. And it wounds me even to be in that level of awareness. But you'll hear me say that awareness is the greatest gift that I think that God ever gives us, because we cannot change anything until we become aware. So the wounding is our awareness that we are separate from God and that there are obstacles in the way and the ascent and the return journey. We're trying to understand the infinite teachings of John of the Cross, of a master teacher, with our finite mind. So we're trying to put it in words and move from 16th century language to our contemporary time, and also to make it relevant to our life today. What is John saying to us today? What can we hear? Can we hear one thing today that is going to make a difference in our committed spiritual journey? And how do we find words for dark experience? Or is it really dark? Because you have to understand, it's a metaphor. How he uses dark in his 16th century language, it is a metaphor, and it's still a metaphor in our contemporary time. To me, when you say dark, when I think about John, I think I can envision in my mind, it's sort of like a cloud that comes upon me at some stage of my journey that shrouds my rational understanding. America wants to know. The world wants to know. We all want payback and we want a reward. So John is saying that God, in God's infinite mercy and grace in our life, that there comes upon us this darkness. It's not evil. It's not depressing. It is not dangerous. It is not occult. It is not desperate. But it shrouds us in secrecy, where we are unable to grasp the very important and depth of work that God is effecting, the transformation that God is effecting in the deepest recesses of our being. So it is the experience of being simultaneously wounded, because that's what happens first, but gradually being healed by the divine physician. So we said that John often uses imagery to express himself in his poetry, to tell us how he progressed on the journey and the obstacles in his way. So the dark night, yes, is a sort of death experience to our old self. I've heard it called the lower self. We can say the false self. But you have to understand, too, that John is not talking about our personality or our persona or who we think we are. He's talking and refers to us as soul. Interestingly enough, in Teresa's mansions, after the third mansion, she no longer spoke about us as personality, but she began to refer to us as souls, as humanity, as souls. So to me, the dark night and its death experience is a flatlining, in a sense, of the soul. We mentioned faith. Maybe we'll have time to revisit that again this morning or sometime during the day. And books 2 and 3 of The Ascent of Mount Carmel focuses on faith. And the crux of John's teaching on faith is that he impresses upon us that our intellect alone cannot acquire the knowledge that faith will afford us, or fully understand the content of faith once it is revealed. He speaks of the active purification of the sense. We're going to move into that now, and the spiritual faculties in the ascent. So anyway, the books I've also mentioned, let me mention this very quickly, the books that I recommend and I use in putting together the presentations are, of course, the collected works of John, because they're translated by Carmelites and they understand the bridal mysticism, the spousal theology of the Carmelite charism. And I particularly like When Gods Die. I love that title, saying really when false gods die, or what we thought was really isn't. And it's by John Welch, who is another Carmelite. And of course, the 2 chapters in Invitation to Love by John of the Cross, by Thomas Keating. He would love that. And where he talks about the Night of Sense and Night of Spirit and does a wonderful job of just bringing it down to basic common language, and anyone, I think, can understand it. And Nestor or somebody, if I could have a little water, I would really appreciate it. Okay. Now, if we don't understand anything more about the Night of Sense, there is one thing about the Night of Sense that I probably missed the first, second, third, or fourth time that I read it or heard about it or listened to someone speak about it. The Night of Sense is designed to wean one from the experience of God through sense perception to the physical senses. I'm going to say that again. And this is in your handout. The Night of Sense is custom designed to wean one from the experience of God through sense perception, the physical senses. So, let me just go to the board again. And some of you know that I love to do a workshop that's called The Stages of Prayer as Related to Faith Development. And in that, I separated into three primary stages of our spiritual journey. And the first stage is what we receive as children in an institutional or communal setting. We talked this morning about, and last night, about when we are introduced to this impression of God, our concept of God, at an early age, and everything that we believe about that. And I love this workshop because it's interactive, and the people who attend actually do the workshop, and they share stories and how this was for them and what was their first impression or image of God. Interesting. And then we go to this place where God invites us to new covenant. But we are still living under prescribed values. We talked about axial shifts just briefly last night. And incidentally, I looked up that historical consciousness and the information on that. It's in When Gods Die. It's on page 34 through 37. We don't have time to get into that, but we were talking about axial shifts in historical consciousness that happened between the centuries, the 14th and the 17th century. And the major emphasis was that, what the author was saying about that, is that the human brain and human evolution had reached a point where we could become aware and reflect upon our experience, our lived experience. So this is a little exercise in that. And what are the axial shifts and the critical thresholds that moved you from one place in your relationship with God to another? This had to happen in everybody's life in this room, or you would not be here today. Okay? So, but if we think we've arrived here, the Spirit is good to us and says, wait, there's more. I always think of that infomercial on TV where they're selling something and it's always $19.95, and you're going to get one, but wait, there's more. And so if you're willing to pay the $19.95, you get one, and then you get one free. So they allow you to think that you're getting one free. So the covenant legal is when, I call this the honeymoon period of our relationship. And we do strange things here, like buy books and go on retreats and go to talks and maybe seek out a spiritual director, are watch videos or do really strange things. But something is happening within us. We may not even know that we have crossed an axial shift. We may have come to a critical threshold first, or sometimes in our unknowing, just slide through, and all of a sudden this begins to happen. Later in life, if we are sincerely committed to the journey, and we don't abandon the journey when we come to a night of sense, because Thomas Keating will say that is the greatest temptation, and many people abandon the journey at the night of sense. So there's the final stage, which I would call prophetic innovative, and that, of course, is the contemplative journey. And again, if we can consent, we may come to another critical threshold, and there may be many in our life, but I have synthesized it to three primary or major stages. So we have a lot of fun with this, and I have learned so much from so many people over the years, and been able to kind of look at some of the norms along the way in the spiritual journey. Yes, God leads us through our particular journey in God's unique way, according to our unique life. But there are some norms along the way. So I passed out this, it looks sort of like a roadmap. Because it speaks to what we're doing here today. It's another metaphor. And you will see that the curvy lines here represent the hills and valleys of our life and of your life. So it's a simple roadmap. It may need realigning for your life. I put it together maybe a year or two ago. And I can also see at this point in time, I would change a few things around. But what's interesting is that you might look at this and go home from this day's event and create your own roadmap and the hills and valleys of your life and of your spiritual journey. It's a very interesting process, and I wish we had time to do this together. This makes a wonderful retreat exercise. So, anyway, the night of sense, you can see on there where perhaps the night of sense can enter into our journey. Right here would be the norm, and remember, this is not set in stone, that might be the night of sense. And again, I call this the honeymoon period. And many people in that period have a felt sense of God. Our God in his goodness allows us to know that it's real. I know my adult children, once in a while, they're hesitant to ask me about God, you know, and they sort of whisper to each other, don't ask mom about God, don't bring up God. But once in a while, they will ask a pertinent question, and I know that something's working in them. And I tell them, I cannot tell you anything about God. It's unknowable, but I do know that whatever it is real. That's all that we can say. So in God's grace in your life, or your relationship with God, aided by grace, you may have come to some sort of realization of your relationship with God. The Spirit may have entered and touched you in a profound way. Some people have extraordinary spiritual experiences along the way, and some never do. And what Ruth Burroughs, a Carmelite nun, in her book, the title will come to me, but she speaks about lights on and lights off. Why do some people have lights on experiences and these wonderful experiences of God, as both Teresa and John of the Cross experienced? And why do some not? And John's counsel to us is that if you have it, it's temporary. because there's more. Thomas Keating has spoken to that, and he has said that maybe some people have extraordinary spiritual experiences in the beginning of their spiritual journey because they are most needy. And like Paul, they need to be knocked off the donkey to understand that there's a reality that is working in their life. So we don't really know why, but even those who don't have lights on experiences, extraordinary experience, may just have the joy and the felt experience of knowing that they are known by God. What a gift. And so we're growing through all these books, these relationships, these communities that we seek out of like minds, spiritual directors that we can talk to. You never want to talk about your extraordinary spiritual experience with your neighbor over a cup of coffee. So things are happening, and we're growing, and we're becoming, and we are letting go of a lot of things, and we are beginning, particularly in this stage, to look at those obstacles in our way. So John is celebrating those stages with us, but he is saying, wait, there's more. And really it's God saying, oh, you know, I love what Thomas does sometimes, and he will say, oh, well, God gets really excited now. Now we can really go to work. So God is really going to work, and he says, you're ready. You are moving, time to move into a more mature stage of the spiritual journey. And we hit a roadblock along the way, and it's called the Night of Sense. So if we have had any facsimile of experience or felt feeling, those kinds of nuances in our relationship with God, let me say this again, the Night of Sense is custom designed now to wean us from the experience of God or the expectation of the experience of God through sense perception. Do you understand that comment? Okay. You can be honest. Okay. Generally, we have the expectation of experiencing God through our humanity, through our humanness, and the physical senses that accompany our humanness. Does that make sense? Okay. So we feel uplifted. We may feel joy. We may feel on a high sometimes, and then we may feel on a low sometimes. And sometimes I remember in the early stages of my journey where I would feel really low if I had no felt sense of God in my prayer, in my spiritual life. I had to have something tangible to inspire me and keep me moving on this journey. And I remember one little example. I came into a stage where verbal prayer, discursive prayer, rote prayer was always difficult for me. And I remember as a child in parochial school, sister said that prayer is like having a bank account. Well, in second grade, I didn't really understand bank accounts. But the more that you prayed, she said, the bigger your bank account gets. Well, I realized in my life that my bank account was paltry at best. And that sort of lingered with me through my life. And I would tire easily of verbal prayer, rote prayer, recited prayer. And although I see the value in it and some I loved, it was tedious for me. So anyway, I came to a stage where I began to pray in images. and I had attended a Little Rock Bible study where Scripture became alive. And I began to see that every personality in Scripture is an aspect of ourself. And so it became so alive that that prayer for me in images was very easy, and that lingered with me for several years. And then came the day when I could not conjure up an image if my life depended on it. It was a blank slate. And of course, the sense of the imagination and our senses are very involved in praying in images, and it's a wonderful thing. And I think it's a very precious stage of the journey. Many people go through it, and some people don't, and they bypass that, or they are satisfied with other forms of prayer. So I felt very abandoned at that time. In retrospect now, I know that that was one of the first stages of the Night of Sense, because I wanted that feeling that prayer was really happening and that God was in that prayer. I had a sense of presence in those images. What I realize now in retrospect, and please hear me, there is no good or bad way to pray. No good or bad way. God leads us through different stages of our life. But what I realized is that in the use of my human imagination, I could change those images at any given time. That I was still in control of my prayer. We have always been in control of prayer. Does that make sense? We decide when we're going to pray, to whom we're going to pray, where we're going to pray, how we're going to pray, what prayers we're going to say, for whom we are going to pray, and when we're going to end the prayer. And I always got a feeling later on in life, not at that point in time, because I didn't realize that I was so in control of my prayer until I had that experience of hitting a brick wall. And I could no longer use these images for prayer, or these images were no longer available to me to enhance my prayer and what I thought enhanced my relationship with God. So I think in just saying a little piece about centering prayer, and you may have heard me say this before, because I say this in the Teresa in the Interior Castle. What I love about centering prayer is that, number one, I may love it. A lot of people have difficulty because it's so countercultural. The moment we sit down in the chair and we ever so gently introduce our sacred word, or maybe we're using sacred breath or sacred gaze or whatever, but the moment we do that, we are no longer in control. It's sort of like jumping off the cliff, because from that moment on, the prayer belongs to God, is God's prayer, and God effecting the prayer in us, in the deepest recesses of our being, and we no longer have control. If you are a presenter of the introductory workshop, or just speaking to anyone about contemplative prayer or centering prayer per se, how many times will people say, if I'm going to be resting in the presence of God or feel like I'm in the presence of God, shouldn't I be saying words of praise and worship? Shouldn't I be doing something? I should be doing A, B, C, and D. Shouldn't I be doing it? And it's hard for them to hear, no. Be still so that we might know. That we might come into that sacred gnosis. Does that make sense? Okay. So my little example of praying in images and all the senses of my being loved that. And I think in retrospect, and Teresa saying to me in that third mansion, all right, let's do self-disclosure here. What was that all about? And I think that I had moved into a sense of pride that, wow, I'm becoming a good prayer. Because I had so much trouble praying and just reading prayer. I had a tough time just making up prayers and discursive, what we call discursive meditation. So anyway, that was an eye-opener for me, but I didn't know it at the time. All right. Why God stops us in our tracks and weans us from the experience of God through sense perception is because we are involved in an axial shift and a transition to deepen our relationship with God through the journey now of what John is saying. Pure faith. Can you know me by pure faith? And we just, you know, recently heard the gospel of the doubting Thomas. I won't believe until I can put my hand into the womb, into your wound. I can't believe. I can't, my mind can't fathom. I cannot bear just for you to tell me I have to do this on faith because I don't know really what faith is. So what happens now is the gradual development of the intuitive faculties that generally lie dormant within us and the development of the spiritual senses. So God is inviting us of a new way of communicating with God through the intuitive faculties and the spiritual senses. If you want to know more about the spiritual senses, and I know many of you have already watched this video by Father Thomas, it comes in the Spiritual Journey video series right after the Night of Spirit. And he talks about the spiritual senses. But I want you to hear what he says about intuition. A positive benefit of the night of sense and the energies arising from the development of the intuitive level of consciousness. The human brain has potentialities that are still waiting to be actualized. If we can believe the experience of many mystics, the present level of human consciousness is the door to higher states of consciousness. In their view, our human potentialities are only fully realized in transforming union. Okay. So he doesn't say a lot about it here, but he says more about it in intimacy with God, and I think in chapters 7 through 9. And also, When Gods Die by John Welsh, he speaks also of the development of the intuitive faculties. So this begins to take place in the night of sense. Now, there are wonderful, wonderful things about the night of sense, but to me, somehow, we miss that. So the night of sense is the first biblical purification of the desert, as we are told in Invitation to Love, the first purgative desert, the first major purification. It is a marvelous grace. I know Father Thomas Keating and others have said, if you are blessed with the night of sense or the night of spirit, celebrate that, for you are receiving an immense favor from God. So the night of sense is a transitional stage of the journey leading to new growth. Some people will ask me, well, how long does it last? And I just have to say, that's up to God. How long does it take us to come into this new way of being? And we'll only do it in stages and levels. We won't completely arrive. Now, most of you know So let me just back up for a moment. I don't know if I missed here the three classical signs. Okay, here, the three classical signs, which are critical. First of all, when we hit those roadblocks or that brick wall and feel that God is no longer accompanying us on this journey and that we're trying to do this on our own and we forget why we're doing this, it may move us into a state of pervasive, and that means deep, aridity. We may not be able to pray, or if we are trying to recapture the honeymoon period of that prayer, it may seem like straw. We may feel this absence of God that seems to be habitual now during this time. The second sign would be a comprehensive sense that something is wrong. We're feeling a loss. We may feel a sense of grief. We don't know what's going on with our spiritual life. We're kind of bottomed out. But one of the things on the flip side of the coin to that is that in the night of sense, there is most likely to be turmoil in our external life. So turmoil in our internal life, interior life, and turmoil in our external life. And I can remember that was certainly the truth about my experience of night of sense, that there was certainly turmoil in my external life too. So it seems like life at that time is just a big ball of messy. So there's little satisfaction now. Remember the honeymoon period. How many of you participated in the charismatic renewal? Oh, many of you. Many people. It's amazing to me. I live in St. Louis, Missouri, in the Midwest, and many people come to contemplative outreach who have experienced that wonderful movement of the Spirit in the charismatic renewal. I think how wonderful that time was, that recreated the Catholic Church in a sense where we began to hear so much of the Spirit. So, however, what I have noticed over the years is that so many people who came to contemplative outreach and embrace centering prayer, we have one foot in the contemplative dimension because all of the hoopla and the highs have more or less balanced out and may have dissipated, but we have one foot back here trying to regain what we feel that we have lost or what God has subsided in our life. And I certainly tried to do that with the praying in images, trying to recapture that, but for some reason it no longer works. So our formal spiritual practice, our practices, may no longer produce the highs of what we experienced in that honeymoon, very special relationship. And there is a temptation to abandon the prayer, but we just kind of hang in there, although Thomas has said that many people leave the journey when this is present in their life. And note, too, that all three of these signs must be present to be an authentic night of sense. I often hear people these days saying, oh, gosh, I'm going through such a dark night, you know. And I think if we really understood what a dark night was, we wouldn't apply it to most mishaps in our life. Again, the night of spirit too, and maybe I should wait to go ahead and say it since I started, is not depression. It is distinct from depression, so we'll talk about that when we come to the night of spirit. The night of sense, as we said, may no longer produce consolation or benefit. And it is designed to heal illusion. And this is Thomas's quote from the Invitation to Love. Concupiscence, and I will tell you, it took me 2 years to learn how to pronounce that. Weakness of will, but it is also custom designed to enable us to dismantle the emotional programs for happiness. Okay? We are asked to assume a disposition of waiting on God in faith and trust. For the God of pure faith transcends perhaps our former concepts, impressions, and consolations. So we've talked about the three senses, but John tells us that it will be accompanied by three classical trials. And many of you have had expert teaching on those three dominant energy centers that often have us in a stranglehold. And that is, and you tell me, without looking at the screen, tell me those three dominant centers that are active in your life. Right, right. Yeah. Yes. In the night of sense, the three classical trials, the spirit of blasphemy, the spirit of dizziness, which is an odd word that I think emerged from the 16th century, I would call it the spirit of certitude, and the spirit of fornication. So, in the spirit of the night of sense, we have lost all sense of certainty of our spiritual journey and relationship with God as it appears to us. In the spirit of blasphemy, we have a tendency to blame God for our current situation and for perhaps the external trials of our life that are going on at that same time. And because we have embarked on this committed spiritual journey, shouldn't we be having a life of bliss and good times and easiness and comfort instead of all of the turmoil that we are experiencing within and without? And in the spirit of fornication, which in our minds and in our English language often speaks to us of the abuse of the sexual energies of humanity, but it can also speak to the void, that there is something that we need or want and desire, but we can't name it, and there's an empty place inside of us, sort of a vacuum, that in the early stages of the spiritual journey, it was being filled by that sense of the presence or just knowing that God is and is with us in faith, as where our faith was in our journey at the time. So how do we fill that vacuum? How do we reclaim what we thought that we had? Any questions about this? The three trials, the spirit of blasphemy, yes, dizziness, or fornication, yes.
In the previous example, you said that the earmark would be that you would have all three of them together.
Yes.
Is that true here in the trials?
Yes. Well, it's not spoken of, but I think it's really imperative, John is saying, to see it as a authentic night of sense. But he doesn't speak to that. Any questions about the spirit of blasphemy? Yes.
Something came to me when you said that was the one where we have a tendency to blame God.
Sure.
So I was thinking, when we blame others, if I blame others, I think it's that same spirit. And then the purification comes when I'm no longer blaming others or God.
Yeah. Yes. But we may stay in this for a long time. And it may be 6 months, it may be 6 years. And the dismantling process is unique to each one of us, what we have to dismantle, how much we can give our consent, to what extent can we consent. And I've told the story before, some of you have heard this, about my spiritual director, who was always saying to me, I know that he thought I was a spiritual problem child. And he would say to me, if you just surrender, Susan. And I got so tired of hearing it. And finally, one day I said, I would if I knew what it was. It's sort of nebulous, like faith. If you just had faith, and he would say that too. Well, if you just had faith, well, I thought I did have faith. Well, if you just surrender, well, I thought I had surrendered. So, okay, so I'm not surrendering. What is surrender? At this stage of my life, I can, and in retrospect, I can look back and realize now that I went through four stages to get to a place of surrender. At that point, with the obstacles at that point in my life, I'm not talking about that I've achieved a full state of surrender, for heaven's sake. There's, you know, it's, wait, there's more. So anyway, but I come back to the gift of awareness. Lord, if you don't give me anything else in my life, give me the gift of awareness, because I cannot change anything. So the first step of surrender is that we must become aware. And Teresa drilled this into her novices. And she was hard on herself when she had wasted 21 years in the monastery sleeping in prayer in the mornings. But when she became serious, she became serious. So awareness is such a gift from God. And it is part of the dark nights, because God is striving to bring us into awareness so that we may better consent. And finally, surrender. So the first step would be awareness. The second is, I realize what I am still holding on to, what I am still over attached to, what I am not detached from, but God help me, I am powerless to change it. I cannot get myself out of this stranglehold of my desire for power and control, security and survival, and exaggerated need for affection, approval, esteem. I'm stuck. Maybe I do better with one or the other. And truly, we have come a great way in this covenant legal stage. Covenant says God is inviting us to a new way of becoming in relationship with God. Legal says, I'm still bringing some baggage with me. I haven't been totally transformed. So the first stage, awareness. The second stage, I'm powerless to change it. The third stage, I consent. And what am I consenting to? We throw that around like we know what that is. All right, now we can say, if you're a spiritual director, we can say to our spiritual directees, well, if you just consent. Okay, what does that mean? To me, there are stages in there's stages of awareness, there's stages in my realization of my powerlessness, there's stages in consenting, and there's stages in surrender. Consenting means that I now open, dispose myself to the Spirit anointing this situation or this obstacle or millions of obstacles, whatever it is, and setting into motion the healing process. I consent to that divine therapy. I'm in therapy and in collaboration with the Spirit. I'm consenting to that. Doesn't mean I'm healed. It doesn't mean that I've fully consented. I know that there are people here who are very much into body work. And we know that the welcoming prayer, oftentimes the welcoming prayer, we know when we need to welcome by the virtue of our body reaction. If we are totally surrendered, if we are partially surrendered, are partially consenting, I can usually feel it. You know, if John would ask me, do you have absolute trust in God? I would feel in my solar plexus where I'm not. I would feel if there was still some residue, some residual stuff there where I cannot move to absolute trust. My body will tell me, I will feel myself retaining what I cannot yet give up. So that's a part of awareness, and it's not a detriment. Like, do I fall into depression because I can't say I have absolute faith, or I have absolute trust, or I've totally surrendered? Every step is a part of our transformation on the way, and we need to celebrate every step of the way. We have into eternity to be transformed. So, in the spirit of fornication, you know, we're in the night of spirit, being a spiritual director, there are these sexual innuendos that arise in us, or these nuances that stem from our culture, the not understanding of that divine energy, the abuse of that divine energy, and the cultural ways that the energy today is abominably abused. So I think that probably our adult children may have a more difficult time with understanding that than we do. So that in that sense of the word, that can certainly emerge early in the night of sense. It can, if it hasn't been dealt with, it can revisit one in the night of spirit or at some stage of life. In the spirit of certitude, when our loss of certainty impacts our feeling of being secure in the love of God, secure in our belief system, sometimes at this point in time, our belief system rug is pulled out beneath us. And we do begin to question, you know, what is real? What is true? So oftentimes, I think the night of sense in the divine therapy and the healing, we begin to throw out what we know is not true and has not served us well. And the spirit of blasphemy, I think, especially in the first throes of the night of sense, I have to blame someone. The earmark of communication in our culture today is accuse and blame. And all you have to do is watch what's going on in this election process for this year. And if I don't have the answer, or if I'm hurting or whatever, I have to find someone to accuse and blame for my predicament. And so in the night of sense, we tend to blame God because I did A, B, C, and D. And I was serious about my commitment. I did all these things. Look how many books I read. Look where I went. Look at all the things I did. Look how I've been meditating. Look how serious I am at the spiritual journey. And why am I being treated by God like this? Well, maybe I'll just go play golf, or I'll just go back to the mall, or I'll do whatever I need to do in life. And sometimes we do that. And you had a question, sir. Our comment.
Distinguishing the words of Father Keating and the words of John on the cross in your presentation. These words here from the night of sense that you have, are
yes.
They the words of John of the cross?
Yes. The words of John of the cross are the spirit of blasphemy, the spirit of dizziness, which I said I prefer certitude, and the spirit of fornication, which I would supplant that with a different word. And I don't know what that word would be yet, but anyway, I think there could be a better example of that word. So what Father Keating has done in his brilliance is he has taken it and looked at it deeply and see that the spirit of blasphemy impacts our exaggerated need for power and control, because we thought we were in control of our spiritual journey. I mean, we're doing A, B, C, and D, and it seemed like God was cooperating with us. Does that make sense? Crazy, crazy. So God is saying, in the wait, there's more. And a total loss of control. Yes?
Talking about the spirit of fornication, I was looking at what Father Keating said, and he mentioned overeating as well.
Yes.
As you know, another example other than too much sex. And, you know, it kind of struck me, isn't that basically the sins of lust and gluttony? I mean, does it more or less approximate that?
Of course. Of course. Of course.
And what I wondered is, can we assign some of the other, is it the capital sins or the cardinal sins? I can't remember which they are, but can we assign some of the other sins to the spirit of blasphemy and the spirit of dizziness or confusion?
I think that we could, but I think that's getting very intellectualized about and trying to put it into categories. I think it's enough for me personally on my journey just to say that there are times that I have railed at God because I want my spiritual journey to be perfect. Look at all the energy I'm putting into it. I never planned to do this in my life. Does that make sense? So I could go back in my Baltimore catechism and find out and attach, you know, if I wanted to do that kind of research and attach other definitions to this. But I think Thomas's definition and application of the power and control to the spirit of blasphemy. We have to accuse and blame someone because we just can't own up. I'm not in the spirit of consent yet. I haven't surrendered yet. I'm not transformed. So I have to find somebody to blame. Okay. Let's take a 10 or 15 minute break and come back.